All right. Welcome, everyone. Look at this full screen of people. This is so cool. I'll go around and say hello to each person, and then we'll do announcements. So I will start with, it's always just a random assortment. So I'll start with Etzido and Bob K. Amanda, Sam, Marv, Mark W, Sarah, welcome, Karen, Jim, John, Joseph, Vin, Mick, Mary, Pat, Shoketsu, Joan, Alice, Bob O, Claudia, Bruce, So-on, Chrissy and friend, Sabrina, Peter, Yeshe Soki, David, Jessica, and Amelia. All right. And Paulette. Hello, Paulette. I love your what is it called? Not an emoji, but your avatar, your avatar. Cool. All right. So, let's see, in terms of announcements, precept study begins on Tuesday, April 13th. And next Sunday, well, actually next Saturday, I'm going to be participating in a peaceful, disruptive, nonviolent civil disobedience action in Portland around the climate crisis. There's a possibility that on Sunday morning I may be in, let's see, I may be in jail or still locked to a boat, not in the water. If anybody's curious about that, feel free to contact me if you want to come on down and see it if you're in the area. But just, I may be here, I may not be, but just in case I'm not, I've made alternative plans, and So-on will be giving us our talk next week. And do you have any idea what you're going to talk about, So-on? Oh, we can't hear you. And then I did hear on another announcement, Amanda, do you want to share your idea?
Oh gosh, yes. We were in the middle of a really interesting chat in our breakout group, and I was saying I will email a link out on the mailing list for another Zoom if you'd like to just chat over lunch, which I suppose is sort of like the virtual equivalent of Pat and Pat would always organize these lovely lunch meetings after the Sangha when we'd meet in person. So I guess this is the virtual equivalent of
Some
that.
people could go grab a snack and come back. And you might want to, Amanda, if you have a chance to send a Zoom link via chat. Not all the folks on here would be hooked up by our
Great
email.
call. I will do that now.
And so on. Are you with us now? No, we can't hear you. Oh,
Webcam, is that
there
working?
you go. There you
Okay.
go.
Yeah, I've got everything plugged into this and that and the other thing. So I was thinking about talking about the song of the Grass Roof Hermitage.
Ooh,
That poem that I
cool.
love so much. Yeah. I was thinking of just have you done that? I know
No, I
I'm not
haven't.
always.
No, I have never talked about it.
Yeah. Like my favorite.
And
So that's us.
Mick, who is with us?
You gonna say hi to everybody, George?
Hi, George.
That's dumb. Yeah, we listen to the podcast in the car, and so you're like, you're famous to George.
Hi, George. This is Domio. Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, you already said hi. Okay.
Cool. All right. Sounds good. So today, my Dharma talk, I'm calling the Buddhist moral precepts as a practice for studying the Buddha way. So I've done quite a number of podcast episodes on the precepts, but not really one about how we approach the moral precepts as practice in our particular lineage. And we're going to be studying the precepts starting April 13th. And we study them every year. So this is actually, in many Zen lineages, somewhat unusual. I mean, in Soto Zen, precepts are pretty central, but we study them every year. Like, there's, you know, like clockwork, we study the precepts again. So it's understood that this is a very central part of our practice. So I will explain more about that. So our precepts, our 16 Bodhisattva precepts, they're available on the website. I also, you know, have a link and list them on the podcast website. If you have the Bright Way Zen chant book, they are also in the chant book on page 27. That is the text we call the Kyoju Kaimon, which is it's actually a compilation. Dogen wrote a fascicle, an essay called Kyoju Kaimon. And this is like, it includes parts of that, but it also includes some other stuff. So it's kind of a lineage compilation of stuff about the precepts. And when we get to precept study on Tuesday nights, we will actually recite this. So it's a text we refer to, go back to again and again. And so as you can see, and so, I mean, we could do a whole talk just on the text itself, but that's not what this talk will be. So you can tell from that text, we call them the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. First of all, it's not a precept, but we start with the gateway of contrition. And I plan to do a whole Dharma talk on the gateway of contrition. So this is, you know, all my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So to use the common cultural phrase, you can't work on your problems until you admit you have a problem. So basically we're saying we want to do better. We want to find a new way. Then we take refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And I guess each refuge is considered a precept. I'm not sure why they're counted that way. Then we have the three pure precepts. Cease from harm. I guess the chant book says evil. We have an alternative translation that I say harmful action, because that's really what we mean. Release all self-attachment. Do only good, take selfless action. Do good for others, embrace all things and conditions. So I've heard it said that essentially that could be enough. That pretty much covers it. But then we have the grave precepts, because, you know, people need it spelled out. So then it gets more specific. Do not kill, cultivate and encourage life. Do not steal, honor the gift not yet given. So each one is phrased in kind of a restraint, negative, if you will, term, and then in a positive term. Do not steal, honor the gift not yet given. Do not misuse sexuality, remain faithful in relationships. Do not speak dishonestly, communicate truthfully. Do not become intoxicated, polish clarity, dispel delusion. Do not dwell on past mistakes, create wisdom from ignorance. Do not praise self or blame others, maintain modesty, extol virtue. Do not be mean or stingy with dharma or wealth, share understanding, give freely of self, do not indulge anger, cultivate equanimity, and do not defame the three treasures. Respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, and nourish the Sangha. So I have done 4 podcast episodes so far on the precepts. My podcast episodes 22 and 23 are How Buddhists Should Behave, Evolution of the Buddhist Precepts. So I start with the history of the emphasis on ethical behavior in Buddhism, which starts right from the beginning with the Eightfold Path, right action, right speech, right livelihood. So right from the beginning, Buddhism acknowledges that ethical behavior is central to spiritual practice and progress on the path. And then in an original Buddhism, the story goes that there weren't any rules at the beginning. But then the monks, they started getting up to stuff, and the Buddha made rules as people did stuff. Okay, now you shouldn't do that, and you shouldn't do that, and you shouldn't hoard material, and you shouldn't lie, and you shouldn't whatever. So the rules were made as necessary. And then my precepts or my podcast episodes take you through the history a little, and then we get to the Mahayana precepts, which, according to the history, they took those original precepts and then they added more idealistic precepts about, you know, commitment to the welfare of all beings. And then my episodes 60 and 61, I talk about taking refuge in precepts, the significance of becoming a Buddhist. So in 60, I describe our lineage's approach to precepts. And this the ceremony of Jukai and formally becoming a Buddhist and all that. So if you're curious, check it out. And then 61 describes lay vows in a Theravadan community and a Vajrayana community, and also talks about the importance of vow generally. So this talk is the, like I said, the precepts as practice. So not just a way to constrain our behavior so we don't make a mess of our lives. So in a way, this is like, you know, on the one hand, basically the Buddha argued, if you're lying and stealing and cheating and committing adultery and, you know, bad-mouthing people and whatever, like, you're not going to be able to focus on your spiritual practice. Your life's going to be a mess. You know, you're going to be worried about stuff, stressed. You know, it's like the whole like thief looks behind the door, right? If you're engaging in that kind of stuff, that's a very different mindset you're going to have. So they definitely have that purpose of like helping us keep some order in our lives. And, you know, they express an ideal of behavior. And at the very least, we fake it till we make it, right? We try to just follow them because it's a good idea. So they definitely have that purpose. But in terms of practice, so when I say practice, I generally mean something we consciously choose to do in order to relieve suffering and cultivate wisdom and or compassion. So, you know, this can be something formal like meditation or Dharma study or participating with Sangha. I mean, it can be much, you know, from tiny to major to subtle to formal. Picking up your teacup with two hands helps you be mindful. Maybe centering yourself in your breath when you're having a difficult conversation. It's all these kinds of things. Or maybe practicing metta when you are, you know, feeling a lot of stress or anger, or anything that you consciously choose to engage in or do that helps the situation. So precepts as practice, specifically as a practice for studying the Buddha way. So Dogen says in Genjo Koan, oft quoted and rightfully so, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So really I could say that the precepts can be a tool for studying the self. But I didn't phrase it that way because that can sound a little too limiting, Like, we're just studying ourselves. We're just navel gazing, obsessing about ourselves and our habits, trying to improve ourselves, perhaps. So I wanted to say, you know, this is about studying the Buddha way. In this, it is, we study the self as a gateway to that. And I will get to that some more, but it's not just about ourself. It's not just about our limited self, but we do start with studying the self. So, because at the root of our problems, according to Buddhism, dukkha, unskillful and selfish behavior based in greed, ill will, and delusion, it's all about our delusion about self-nature. It's either about, you know, the I-making and my-making that we've talked about recently, just identifying whatever we're interacting with as somehow attached to our in well-being, a delusion that our self-nature is enduring, independent, and inherent. And we have some essence inside that we need to protect and look out for, as opposed to a self-nature that is boundless, empty of anything that can be grasped, anything inherent, interdependent with all things, and dependently co-arisen. So there's nothing, you know, if the universe stopped existing, we wouldn't exist either. That's the idea. So Dogen continues, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. So there's, like I said, we go through this gateway of studying the self, but only in order to open ourselves up to a greater reality. So in, like I said, in the Mahayana, precepts became very idealistic. And we have, there's quite an interesting evolution of precepts. When the Mahayana added precepts to the monastic Vinaya in China, there were, I believe, 58 precepts in the Bommyokyo, something like that, which are very interesting to look at. They're you know, if our precepts go from the three pure precepts to the 10, you know, the 58 all are very interesting and apply as well. So, you know, you might check those out. But the idea became, with the Bodhisattva precepts, if you were a Buddha, if you were enlightened, if you understood reality, that your self-nature is interdependent and impermanent, if you understood the fleeting nature of this life, really appreciated the precious opportunity of being a human being, it would not even occur to you to break the precepts. They would not be rules to constrain your behavior. They would be a description of your natural behavior. So, for example, so let's take killing. So I should note that it's understood that because the Bodhisattva precepts are all about wisdom and compassion and being beneficial for self and other, that it's not like, well, go ahead and break them if you think that's the wisest thing to do. But I always say compassion is the trump card. Sometimes we might need to break a precept essentially in order to keep another one. We might need to break it out of compassion, it's not like it's okay. There's still karma from it. There's still repercussions, but it may be something that even a bodhisattva might do, right? Maybe euthanizing an animal when it's in a lot of pain. You know, there's still karma from that, but you could argue it's the compassionate thing to do. Or killing in self-defense, perhaps. I mean, you are included as one of the sentient beings in the universe, and you can have compassion for yourself. So, but generally speaking, killing, in order to kill, we have to cut off. We have to see whatever it is that we're killing as like lesser, different, separate. We're not connected to it. So we're not identifying that as self if we're killing it. We tend to devalue the life that we are killing. And the goal is to extend our sense of connection and intimacy out as far as we can. So a Buddha is unthreatened. A Buddha, like there's stories about the Buddha throwing himself off a cliff in a previous life as a bodhisattva. He threw himself off a cliff to feed a hungry tiger. I mean, this kind of ideal that like, if you were really awakened to reality, you'd just be like, hey, do you need my body? I mean, there wouldn't be this sense of like self-protection that is so natural to us. Stealing, again, unless we need, it's something that we need to survive. Why are we stealing? Either kind of overtly, literally, or subtly, by gaming the system to get more than we would otherwise, or more than our share, or more than is sustainable. Self-concern, greed, fear of lack. So a Buddha gets satisfaction from much deeper, unconditional sources. So they wouldn't, like, why would you steal? Lying. Generally speaking, we're protecting the self in some way in order to preserve our reputation, avoid consequences, avoid uncomfortable conversations, make people think better of us. So I think, first of all, a Buddha wouldn't have so much to hide, right? Wouldn't need to lie. But there's also no selfish concern that motivates a Buddha to hide from the consequences. So the urge to break or bend a precept, you could say, is the arising of the small self. And we can use the term small self to refer to this illusory and problematic sense of an enduring inherent self nature. With small self versus perhaps true self or Buddha nature, because there's no denying we exist. We do exist. We exist as individuals. Well, what we don't exist as individuals the way we usually think we do. Instead, it's much more of a boundless, flowing, ungraspable unfolding. So we exist, but it's not the way we usually think. So we do have, you know, self nature, you might say, even though we say your true self nature is no self nature. So that's another topic. But this small self, this arising of greed or grasping, aversion, fear, ill will, hate, delusion. And delusion isn't just kind of an innocent ignorance in Buddhism. It ends up being kind of like a willful ignorance based on a selfish agenda. So rather than, you know, expanding your view or opening up to the truth or something, no, we'd rather think like this. And all of these things, greed, hate, and delusion arising, have to do with our sense of an enduring, inherent, independent self nature coming into contact with a world that can often be hostile or lacking. So the very aspiration to follow the precepts, whether you've just formed that, you know, personally, or whether you've taken a vow to do that publicly, gives us a background, a reference point, a structure which highlights the arising of the small self. So, I mean, you might, even before you ever found out about the precepts, you might, you know, some of this was probably still happening, but probably only because you had some kind of personal, moral, and ethical, you know, code of conduct that you had aspired to yourself. You want to act like a nice person or be honest or whatever. And so then your rising greed, aversion, and delusion are set against that aspiration. So people who start practicing with the precepts are often shocked, I don't know, maybe not shocked, but disturbed in some way to notice how often they're breaking the precepts. If you adopt this with your as a practice and you're trying to carry the precepts with you throughout the day, it's like, dang, from dawn till dusk, it's just a constant challenge. And there are different levels of precept keeping and breaking. So there's a very, very, you know, literal physical level of keeping the precepts, which is important. And at the very least, we do that, right? Don't kill other human beings. Don't take people's stuff, you know? Don't cheat and lie when you're engaged in sexual activity. Don't fly into a rage, right? And indulge, you know, unleash your anger on other people. So there's this kind of literal keeping, which is very important. But if you work with the precepts for a while, you can also see where it just gets more and more and more subtle. So even if you aren't breaking those things in a really overt, gross, obvious way, there are ways, for instance, with killing. You know, what does it mean to kill a thought? What does it mean to kill someone's enthusiasm? What does it mean to try to kill or reject or excise or cut off some part of yourself that you don't like? Let's see. Yes, let's see. And then in Archaeojikaimon, that text, after each precept, there are two little verses. And the first one is supposedly from Bodhidharma, and the second one's from Dogen. And the first one is kind of phrases the precepts in a way that's like impossible to keep. The second one phrases it in a way that's like almost they're impossible to break. So the first one for killing, it says holding no thought of killing is keeping this precept. Just a thought of rejection, just a thought of, you know, this is, you are lesser than me, is killing. So that is pretty intense. And then when you get to the later precepts on speech, do not praise self or blame others, you know, thinking critically of other people and kind of puffing yourself up. Do not dwell on past mistakes, primarily has to do with speech, like not criticizing and gossiping about people. It gets quite subtle. Not indulging anger. Most of us find that quite a challenge, to never indulge anger. So basically, we find out we break these precepts all day long, especially if we start looking at them in more subtle ways. But this means the precepts are an awesome opportunity if we use them as a practice and not just as a bludgeon to beat ourselves up with. We don't spend that much time sitting or doing Dharma study or other formal aspects of our practice. But the precepts are all about relationship. So we can practice with them from dawn till dusk. I mean, pretty much any time, you know, on the cushion, we like to say, when you're doing Zazen, you're not breaking any precepts. Well, at least not literally. In your mind, you might be. But, you know, it's definitely anytime you're off the cushion, going about your tasks, interacting with other people, the precepts come up constantly. So there's just an opportunity to bring practice into our everyday life. And the urge to break a precept, we recognize is a red flag or a mirror. It says, pay attention. The small self has arisen. So generally speaking, we don't do this in order to notice how terrible we are and thereby try to wrestle our small self into submission. Generally doesn't work. we might do this in order to prevent imminent harm, right? You're just about to like let out the, you know, nasty words in anger. Okay. And you might just like bite your tongue, right? So there there's in that level, there's this, maybe you would just like try to stop and abide by the precept. But most of the time when we're doing, when it's more subtle, we're basically just want to become mindful. We just want to shine the light of awareness on what just happened or what is happening or what you, the urge to break a precept. So we're reflecting, we might be reflecting on a situation where we've broken a precept, reviewing an unskillful conversation, where we criticized others and puffed ourselves up and got into it. And then later we're like, oh. So we just turn the light of awareness on what's happened. And remember that the precepts describe the behavior of a Buddha. So if we have truly awakened to reality, we don't break precepts, or we don't even want to. So our precept breakage highlights where we have not yet awakened to reality, to the reality of the nature of self, the boundless and interdependent, impermanent nature of existence. Now, if we react and judge and immediately try to change what we see to our reaction, chances are we're not going to be able to see clearly. So we really want to have this, give this some space as we practice doing with mindfulness. If we can see clearly what's going on, we have a chance of learning, of waking up. So first, we notice in precept practice, we notice after our karma has played itself out, our karmic pattern. So it's like, oh, crap, I did that again. Oh, no, you know, I drank too much again last night. I let anger fly again. So it's like, it ends up being this reflection practice, so that even some, there's actually even a formal practice of just reading the Kyoju Kaimon at the end of the day, and then just noticing where, you know, little memories go, oh, oh, right, I guess I was doing, you know, breaking a precept there. Over time, we notice, we might notice as we're breaking a precept, but we can't do anything about it. We can't stop ourselves. So then you can reflect on it, right? What went on there? What happened? And then we might notice over time, the urge to break a precept arises, but we still can't stop our behavior. Eventually, and this isn't just like, okay, now magically all the areas of your life apply to this, but in each thing that we're working on, we can perhaps get to a point where we notice ahead of time, oh, this is where things get dicey. And then we can make some different choices. We can change the topic, or we can, you know, go meditate or study, or we can go for a walk, or we can make some different choices about what we do next. So at times, as we're working through this, precept work may seem very kind of very practical, nitty-gritty about our karma, our conditioning, our attachments, our habits. It can feel kind of slow. It can seem challenging, or it even end up feeling like a kind of a daunting self-improvement project sometimes. So it's important to always remember that this is in the context of practice, where the idea is to open up to the greater implications of everything. So it's, you know, we do have to focus on the nitty-gritty sometimes, but if you can, you know, rather than just, you know, oh, I notice I want to reject that thing. How do I stop rejecting that thing? Or why am I rejecting that thing? If you really, yeah, you ask that question more deeply. What is really going on here? What am I afraid of? What can I let go of? A lot can make itself known in that situation. And so eventually we become more and more familiar with our small sense of small self. So this is where, you know, Dogen says, Buddhas have become very, they're enlightened with respect to delusion. They're very, very, very familiar with delusion. Like, and we're, you know, deluded about what enlightenment is. They're enlightened about delusion. So we examine our delusions. We examine our negative habits, and we begin to be able to see the small self operating. And if we can maintain our mindful awareness and attention and our willingness to pay attention, we can see things unfold over time. This is where, like, so I was talking about mindfulness in a recent class, and it being like binoculars, and you're keeping whatever you want to look at, mindfulness is like keeping it in the binoculars and not just like wandering off, putting the binoculars down, right? So what we're keeping, we're going to keep, like, you know, that troublesome conversation that I had where I got irritable and I wanted this person to go away, right? I'm just going to try to keep this whole thing in my mindful, my mindful binoculars long enough that I can see, all right, when I did this, that happened. And then when I did this, that happened. And we begin to see how breaking the precepts hurts. Breaking the precepts makes us sad. It alienates us. It cuts us off. It, you know, we begin to want to keep the precepts naturally. We begin to see how this small self, this arising, so it's not even so much, if we look at it closely enough, it's not even so much there's this small nasty self, this base self, which causes greed, hate, and delusion to arise. We recognize that greed, hate, and delusion, the small self is nothing other than the arising of that greed, hate, and delusion. The small self is something we are so much better off without. The small self is just our whiny reactions to life. So then we, like, isn't that interesting? I could let go of that. I could, you know, we don't let go of it all at once, but I can loosen my grasp of my concern there. And then we become able to experience what Dogen talks about, that forgetting the self, becoming actualized by the myriad things. So rather than defending and fighting for the well-being of this little self in a hostile, lacking world, we can start to participate more joyfully in a universe where we can't hold on to anything. But that's part of the fun. So finally, we call it, you know, if you're the Jukai ceremony, sometimes we say you're going to take the precepts, but it's better to say you're going to receive the precepts. It's not like you can go up there like, all right, I got them. So there's this sweet idea in our lineage that the precepts are a gift, that they're this time-tested set of ethical guidelines and a way of practicing with them that is very precious, so that they are passed down like a gift from Dharma generation to Dharma generation. So you receive them, and then, you know, later ordained, you might do intensive practice and end up, you know, being transmitted as a teacher. And part of that transmission is the transmission of permission to give people the precepts. So that's part of what, you know, myself and Shintai and stuff have received, is like, okay, now you are holding the precepts and can give them to other people, which is very sweet. And, like, yeah, you might be living according to precepts for many, many years before you receive them, but, you know, there's this sweetness about, like, now here you go. And also, I should mention, we sometimes call them guidelines versus rules. And that can sound a little wishy-washy, perhaps. Like, well, you know, our guideline is not to kill, but, you know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. But that's not really how we hold them. It's just, we have no external authority judging us. We don't have a God that's up there watching whether we do this or not. We don't have a central authority. And really, I mean, except in terms of, you know, there's a place for law and there's a place for law enforcement, but kind of short of that, I can't make you keep the precepts. I mean, we can't make one another do anything, especially when we get to this subtle level. Maybe we could keep people from breaking them in the most literal way, but in terms of this deeper aspect of practice, this is up to us. So we take the precepts and practice with them, and we do our own practice. Unless people's behavior is egregious and inappropriate and whatever, you know, it's not my job to point out where you're breaking the precepts. I mean, I might say the way that you expressed yourself had this effect on me, right? Could you please not do that? But it's not up for me to judge for you how well you are keeping the precepts. It's your own practice. And there's something we choose, something we ask for. All right, I will leave it there. Open it up for comments and questions. And certainly anyone who has been practicing with the precepts for a long time, if you have anything you want to add about what it's been like for you, that's very welcome. And if you want to just unmute yourself and jump in, you can. There's also, if you go down at the bottom of your screen on reactions, there's a little raise hand feature if you don't want to just jump in. Sarah.
I have a question. So I don't hear a lot about some of the martial traditions in Zen and Chan Buddhism. And I'm thinking like Miyoto Musashi and some of the solo practitioners that were Zen, but not teachers, right? Do you have any thoughts on kind of that tradition of self-realization in a martial sense, which is in direct conflict with some of the precepts, right? So here you have these great practitioners who are completely committed to their Buddhism and they're breaking a whole bunch of precepts, right? But they're doing it in such a way that it's become like a recognized way of study, or at least, you know, is it a recognized way of study? Is it legit? Would be another question.
That is interesting. That's a very interesting topic. I guess I would say that all spiritual practices can be used for good or ill. Concentration practice depends on what you're concentrating on. So, like, I have great admiration for some of the, the historical folks like you're talking about. I mean, wow. You know, the immense discipline, they, you know, in many cases, like, tapped into something that I've never experienced, that level of concentration. But from the Buddhist point of view, it would be like, that's why we have the precepts. If your spiritual practice is not grounded in these precepts, then it's not legit. I mean, I'm not going to just say like all, because I also took Aikido and I learned a lot from Aikido, but then Aikido is only self-defense martial art, where you are, you know, I really found that as long as you have that sense of small self, you are going to conflict. Whereas if you are, you know, they call it body and mind coordinated, but I would, you know, call it like, if you are, you don't let the self get in the way, then you can take the person's energy, and like, you're not doing anything to them. You're just letting their own energy end up in not hurting you. So there's a lot to be learned there. It's really tricky. I don't know. That's all I have. Other thoughts and observations about precept practice? So on.
Well, yeah, it can get subtle and it can be metaphorical. You know, you don't want to kill somebody's good mood by saying something, you know, glum when they walk into the room and those kinds of things. So over the years, I've noticed, here I am, you know, maybe blaming others, but I have seen somewhat of a tendency to those who have practiced the precepts at a very subtle level, denying the gross level of it. And, you know, well, you know, it really means this, and it does, you know, I can still step on the ants in the park, you know, when it's still, you know, maybe you shouldn't step on the ants in the park. You just walk around them, you know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Like it only matters somehow your internal spiritual state. So, you know, you might as well just steal cable
or drink a bunch, you know, just get really drunk and, you know,
Other thoughts and questions?
I just had a question, Domio. Yeah. Thanks for your talk. I guess when you look at the list of precepts, it can look like a daunting moral project because there's a lot of things to be aware of. So I was just wondering if you'd say something about how maybe, you know, working on one of them really deeply can affect working on the others, maybe indirectly, since doing them all at once would be kind of distracting.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I have heard it said that really, if you work on one precept completely, then you will be working on them all. Like if you really went into that subtlety of stealing and that sense of, you know, self-entitlement and other, and, you know, chances are it's just going to like trickle into all kinds of aspects. Like, I don't know, are you stealing someone's time if you're blathering on and complaining, or are you, I don't know. So yeah. So there's that aspect, which, but I also found for myself, I think of it as being gradually converted to the precepts. So, you know, I took them, I'm like, okay, well, there's this list, I, you know, and I want to become a Buddhist, so I'll agree to the list. But not all of them are that salient or relevant or accessible at any given time. And then a couple, usually like there's a couple that in your life are very central. For instance, I've found the one, do not misuse sexuality. Most of the time that's like, eh. But there's been times in my life where like, that one is just, that is front and central. And then there's, I think of it as there's some of them I can look at, okay, do not kill. I get that one. But some of the more subtle ones, like do not praise self or blame others. Yeah, well, sometimes, or do not dwell on past mistakes, for instance. Well, sometimes you got to call it like it is, and you got to point out that, you know, somebody's doing something that's not helpful. And so certainly this doesn't mean that we're never going to say anything negative or critical about anyone or anything. That doesn't seem like that would work, right? But over time, as we work with it, we can maybe get to understand, what is this addressing? What is this about? You know, what does it feel like when I'm about to break this precept? And then to realize, oh yeah, I don't want to do that. I mean, my example was, you know, I ended up having a sense of humor that was really based on sarcasm and criticism and a lot of times self-deprecation. And I, you know, I like it, gave me something to talk about. I was funny, you know, that's cool. But after a while of working with it, I realized, I watched and I'm like, afterwards, I don't feel good. I really don't feel good. That was not worth it. You know, I got a few laughs and I kept the conversation going, but actually I don't like to self-deprecate like that. And I don't feel that nasty and cynical about everything. And I don't want to reinforce that kind of thinking. So then, you know, then it was like, oh, I took that precept automatically at one point, but now I get it. So I don't know. So it's like, yeah, over time, they begin to make themselves understood, is my experience. Alice.
I just wanted to know that, like, at least for me, it's really difficult to keep the precepts. but like how sometimes someone else breaking the precepts kind of stimulates you to break the precepts. Mm. And it makes things so much harder to keep. Just wanted to note that. I don't know what to do about it other than, you know, trying to keep everything calm.
Well, and that's where I think that's why, like the Buddha said, you know, good spiritual friends are the whole of practice, because, you know, we're so affected by the people around us. So, you know, doing this kind of thing, right? And doing our yearly precept study and listening to other people and them talking about how it's difficult and, you know, how they've practiced with it and all that can really help us and encourage us to remain strong, even when the people around us aren't necessarily, like, it's very difficult not to get pulled into, like, nasty gossiping, you know, if other people are doing it, especially if you're used to it. Sometimes some relationships and friendships are based on that, like bitching about, you know, and how do you, it's, so that's one of the things that the three pure precepts we can think of as our describing the arc of practice with respect to individual precepts. So the cease from evil or harmful action, release all self-attachment, and then do only good, and then do good for others. So, like, the first step often is just, we just got to try to stop, and we don't know what else to do. So it can be very awkward in a way, just like, okay, I don't know what to do here, but I'm not going to yell, or I'm not going to contribute to this conversation. I'm going to sit here awkwardly and people are going to wonder what's up with me. So we just kind of try to stop and we don't know what's going to come next. But then, like, some alternative eventually arises and we find a way. So the example that I use is, you know, with my not helpful speech, and I'd be in conversation with people and, you know, bitching and complaining and, you know, cynical, whatever. And when I just stopped doing that, there was an awkward time where I didn't know how to relate to people or interact. But then I was like, I recognized, you know, people really like being asked questions about how they're doing and, you know, what their interests are. So I would just, like, okay, you know, I don't have to get on the bandwagon here. I can say, you know, how's your trip been, Alice? And you'll be like, oh, okay. And, you know, and it's like this wonderful discovery of an alternative way of being. So I guess, you know, and one of the things that people also, this is such a rich practice, is that when you do decide to follow the precepts or adopt them, and then you really do notice other people breaking them a lot. But those people that we want to remain in relationship with anyway, like, I guess that's where our bodhisattva generosity comes in, where we recognize, okay, they're in a different place in their path. And we want to remain in relationship with them. So we're going to be changing our behavior a little bit, and that might be awkward for them, but eventually we can find a way to, help them. That sounds kind of too, like, demeaning in a way, but in a way to that, like, we do want the people that we want to keep in our lives, we can find, you know, evolve more positive ways to interact with. Not always, but oftentimes. So, you know, just remaining in relationship, getting support from Sangha for our aspirations and being patient with people and non-judgmental, I guess. Got a few minutes left. Oh, look at there you go, Peter.
Thank you. I am a very visual person. I like the image of anything, particularly a mountain. When I climb a mountain, I don't start on all 16ths. I just start at the bottom 16th and work on that one. And I get that this isn't that way. And John asked a similar question. Oh, yeah. You know, it's sort of nice to think I can always go back. You know, I can put my toe in the water and maybe I'll put my ankle in, or maybe I'll pull my toe out altogether. But I also just want to say that there does seem like an opening for a children's book on the precepts or something with a picture, you know, such that we can go to it as an invitation as adults and perhaps, you know, get a helping hand, because from where I'm sitting, it looks a bit like perfection, and either I have to jump in totally or I should not even bother listening to this conversation. You know, it's like I'm looking for access, for mini steps, yeah, and some assurance that I'm not offending others and even being in this conversation.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think people, when they're thinking about whether to, you know, embrace precept practice, either formally or informally, you know, especially if they're going to like receive the precepts, right? And they're like, I don't think I can keep that precept. I mean, some of them, even in a very literal way, like, you know, maybe you cook for your family and your family's a family of meat eaters. So what do you do? Like, do you have to be a vegetarian? What does that mean? There's, or people also want to know, frankly, does that mean I can't drink any wine? Like, what is this really, what should this look like? And I guess it's like, they do describe perfection. And we basically say it's impossible to keep the precepts perfectly. So it is like, it's like the mountain, and we may not be that explicit about all the little steps up the hill, but I don't know. But there's like at least four really good books about the precepts out there. And one of them, she's just, Waking Up to What You Do. And she has some very, you know, specific exercises and ways to think about this. And they talk about each precept specifically. So we really do go into the nitty gritty of trying to embrace each one and explore what it can mean. And yeah, but there is that uncomfortable tension with just like, we cannot keep this perfectly. How hard are we going to try? How much of a break are we going to give ourselves? Yeah. Marv.
Lately, I've been really concerned about a kind of precept conflict, and I haven't really found a way through it. And that has to do with taking vaccines, which have been tested on animals. And even if the animal doesn't die during testing, they will be slaughtered afterwards. It's something that's sort of inescapable in all culture. And I suppose any medicine I ever take is like that. And I'm finding it hard to deal with that, to rationalize it. Do you rationalize it? Is that the point? Mm. What do you?
Well, I totally recommend attending our Tuesday evening precept classes, because, you know, starting April 13th with one precept at a time, this is what we wrestle with, you know, when this comes up, you know, how can we respond? And usually there's a wide variety of responses in the Sangha. You know, if we take things too extreme, I mean, what plants don't matter. Plants, you know, plants can sense things. You know, we have to kill to survive. Yet, obviously, that shouldn't just be a justification for doing whatever the heck we want, right? You know, when I was at the Zen Center, we would often have infestations of mice, and the mice would get into our food and they would destroy our food. And like, then that's waste, right? And that, so we would trap the mice. I mean, live traps are not very effective, and then you just put them in, they go into somebody else's house. So then we would trap those mice, and then we would do a funeral for them. I don't know. You know, I think that that's the thing, is the precepts never give us that absolute answer. You know, this will be okay, that's not okay. It's like, we have to wrestle with each question. And then we shouldn't just justify ourselves and, oh, well, we can just break that because it doesn't matter. You know, I really wish I hadn't thought about that. The vaccines being tested on animals, that's sad. And yet, on the other hand, if we don't take the vaccines, then older folks, people with medical conditions, are likely to die. I don't know. So it's a good question. Can't resolve it today. So we are at 12:18. Thank you everyone for being here. I will close with our dedication. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna parami. And there is a Zoom in the chat if you want to grab a snack and visit with people.
Thanks, everybody. I've got a scramavoo.
Scramavoo. Scramavoo. Bye, all. Thank you, Domio.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Domio, are you available to say anything about your protest, non-violent protest next weekend? Now?
Sure. Let me see. I will. Well, you're not local anyway, right?
I'm in Sacramento.
Ah. Yeah. Well, I'm active with Extinction Rebellion, and we are going to be, according to the public listing, we meet at a certain time downtown at noon. Have a little rally, whatever, and then we walk a short distance and we say some rebels are going to engage in some disruptive, peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience, and you can remain at a safe distance, or you can cheer us on, or you can participate. And what we're going to be doing is, once everybody's in place at this particular intersection, somebody's going to drive up with a boat on a trailer that's a big, huge motorboat that we bought, and it's painted bright pink. It says "Act Now" on one side and "No Safe Harbor" on the other. And the truck is going to park it in the middle of the street at this one particular entrance onto a bridge. And we're going to, you know, jump out and unhitch it, and the truck will take off. And then we're going to put locks on the tires. And then four of us are going to lock ourselves to the trailer. And then we'll see what happens. You know, the cops may be able to prevent that. They may come and, you know, insist we leave right away. But our plan is, if they leave us there, which frankly in Portland, given all the stuff that's happened over the last year, the cops are like, if you're peaceful, we just really can't be bothered. then we're going to try to stay for 48 hours.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if we're going to make it. I mean, we're going to be locked on, like, you put your arm down this metal tube and you have a carabiner and you lock yourself onto something, and you can unlock yourself, but other people can't unlock you. So that's where my Zen training, having done many session, which yeah. basically like sit still, be really uncomfortable and bored.
Mm-hmm. take some sandwiches with the other hand.
And we're going to have a support team, you know, that are there looking out for us, bringing us food, bringing us a loo. We're wearing adult diapers. I don't, you know, yeah. We'll see.
Well, good luck with that, Domia. We'd love to see the photographs of the pink boat.
Yeah. I will share once I'm free.
Yeah.
Is this your first time doing anything like this?
Oh no, she's a rebel.
No, we've done two previous actions in Portland where we've blocked a street, but they've only lasted about an hour each time.
That's very different.
And the cops never yeah. even came. They were just like, whatever. But I did get arrested occupying the governor's office about over a year ago, insisting that she take action against a pipeline. Mm. So yeah, that was pretty cool. That was really well organized. And there was probably about 75 people occupying Governor Brown's office until the building closed. We occupied for about 8 hours, and then she came and talked to us and explained why, of course, she couldn't come out publicly against the pipeline. And we said, that's not good enough. And then the cops were like, okay, now you got to go. Mm. And 21 of us stayed.
Was that also Extinction Rebellion?
No, that wasn't. I mean, there were some Extinction Rebellion folks, but it wasn't just an Extinction Rebellion thing. I mean, you know, it's not like this is like we're doing this for fun. It's not you know, we just want to get arrested for the hell of it. But, you know, it's like this is an emergency and we want to demonstrate that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah. Good luck, Domio.
Yeah.
I'll be with you in spirit on the other side of the pond.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Hey.